You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
In this episode, we are bringing you our first highlight from One Crown Office Row's recent seminar, Erasure, Remediation and Rights of Appeal in Disciplinary Proceedings. We begin with One Crown Office Row's Robert Keller QC and Jeremy Hyam QC discussing appeals by the General Medical Council.
As you'll all be aware, the existence of the right of appeal in the hands of the GMC is both relatively new and relatively controversial. It arose from a consultation paper issued by the Department of Health in August 2014, and 70% of respondents to that consultation did not agree that the GMC should have a right of appeal. The concerns raised by respondents included undermining the role of the NPTS and exposing doctors to a species of triple jeopardy. Having successfully defended themselves before the NPTS, doctors were exposed to the risk and the spectre of their cases being reopened, not only, of course, by the PSA, but also now by the GMC. However, those concerns were brushed aside by the Department of Health, and the new power of appeal was brought in by amendment to the Medical Act on the 31st of December 2015. However, the seeds of its own destruction were sown by one of its own appeals, that is to say, Bower Garber, which you've all already heard about and will already know so much about. And as you'll know, that case generated a huge outcry by members of the profession. In particular, there was concern that simple errors could result in prosecution for gross negligence, manslaughter, and striking off, even if they occurred in the context of broader organisational failings. And so it was that in February of 2016, Jeremy Hunt announced a rapid policy review into gross negligence manslaughter, and that review concluded that the existence of the new right of appeal had caused, quote-unquote, fear and mistrust amongst practitioners. This in turn had impacted the ability and willingness of doctors to engage with their regulator, and in turn had deterred reflection and learning into errors to the detriment of patient safety. And the conclusion of the review, as you will know, accepted publicly by the government, was that the GMC's right of appeal should therefore be removed. And so why, you might reasonably ask, are we now talking about it? Well, for two reasons. One, given its statutory footing, the right of appeal will need to be repealed by statute. It's presently not clear when Parliament will find time to repeal the right of appeal, and so for the foreseeable future, at least, we are stuck with it. And the second point is that the PSA's right of referral is going nowhere, and in reality, the PSA will fill the vacuum caused by the GMC losing its right of appeal, and our view is that similar principles on those referrals will continue to apply. So how exactly does the machinery work? We wanted to draw your attention to three particular features of the appeal system which arise from the recent case law. First, before either the PSA or the GMC can invoke the jurisdiction of the High Court, they must be satisfied that the decision of the NPTS was not sufficient for the protection of the public. That is a freestanding public law decision that must be made lawfully and according to ordinary public law principles. Two things follow from that. First, a decision that the High Court's jurisdiction is to be invoked must be properly reasoned. And second, that a doctor is in principle entitled to know what the regulator's reasons are for seeking to appeal or refer, as the case may be. And in Ray Chowdhury, Lord Justice Bean commented that the GMC should exercise considerable restraint before deciding to appeal decisions on matters such as dishonesty, which were necessarily based upon a nuanced evaluation of testimony of a substantial number of witnesses. Now, in reality, it is going to be extremely difficult to challenge a decision by either body to appeal. A High Court judge, in practice, is very likely to defer to the judgments of the GMC or to the PSA on the question of whether the public interest is served by bringing an appeal. Moreover, certainly it's my view that most High Court judges would take the view that a doctor's remedy is to resist the appeal rather than challenging the decision to bring one in the first place. However, where the bodies have taken different views about whether an appeal is in the public interest, there may be some merit in seeking at least to flesh out what the body's respective views are, so as to embarrass the body that has decided to appeal. So, for example, in Ray Chowdhury, the PSA had declined to refer the matter in the public interest, concluding that there was none. But the GMC nonetheless decided to appeal. Now, the PSA's decision not to refer and their reasons was at the forefront of our skeleton argument and helped, we think, to set the tone for our successful appeal in that case. The second feature of the system is that there is a degree of asymmetry in the respective parties' appeal rights. That is to say that doctors can appeal only where a sanction of some sort is imposed by the MPTS. There is no statutory right appeal of any kind against a warning, nor does a doctor have a right of appeal against adverse or prejudicial findings of fact at stage one, no matter how prejudicial those findings may be, if, that is to say, the findings don't lead to a finding of impairment. By contrast, the GMC can appeal any finding, including that a doctor's fitness to practice is not impaired, and including that a doctor, in effect, should be warned instead of sanctioned. In Ray Chowdhury, it was argued that this gave rise to an inequality of arms under Article 6 ECHR. The Court of Appeal disagreed. But it's interesting to note that part of the court's reasoning was that this apparent inequality was addressed by the availability of judicial review to challenge warnings or adverse findings of fact. And Lord Justice Sale said that the intensity of review in such JRs could be adjusted so far as necessary to the same level as would be applied in an equivalent appeal by the GMC under Section 40A, since the High Court would be obliged to act in a way which is compatible with a doctor's rights under Article 6. And of course, that's an extremely useful observation for doctors wishing to challenge warnings or perhaps adverse findings of fact at stage one in judicial review proceedings. And the third and final general observation we wanted to make is that in both Ray Chowdhury and in Baragaba, the Court of Appeal made some very helpful observations about the correct approach to be adopted on appeal by the General Medical Council. In both cases, the Court of Appeal observed that restraint was to be exercised by the court if it was being invited to overturn findings of the tribunal. Such appeals were, as a matter of civil procedure, to be conducted by way of review rather than by rehearing. Moreover, as Bill has pointed out, decisions about impairment and sanction were multifactorial and involved the tribunal having to answer what was in the end a jury question on which there was scope for reasonable decision makers to disagree, and the fact that the court might itself reach a different answer was not of itself sufficient to allow an appeal to succeed. The court should only intervene if the tribunal had committed some error of principle or if its decision fell outside the bounds of reasonable judgment. The judgment of the tribunal was always entitled to substantial respect, partly because they had the benefit of hearing the live testimony of witnesses, but also because they had particular expertise in the field in which they operated. And with that, I'm going to hand over to Jeremy for some observations about Baragaba.
Well, before I turn to some lessons learned and some reflective learning from the Baragaba case, I think in relation to appeals and the point that Rob's been making about the GMC's approach, it's worth, if I remind you, what Charlie Massey, the chief executive of the GMC and the registrar, explained to the select committee on about the 18th of October when asked to answer questions. Rosie Cooper asked him the question, "We've talked all afternoon about learning lessons. I'd ask you, what lessons have you learned from the decision-making? More importantly, will you give up the right to have an appeal, or will you wait for legislation to stop you being able to appeal?" Charlie Massey. "There are many lessons we've learned through this process. The announcement we made last week around bringing human factors disciplines into our processes was a very important piece of learning. for us. We've always taken system factors into account, and we've made decisions around fitness of practice processes, but the systematisation and bringing more consistency into our processes by bringing human factors, disciplines, methodologies into it is a really important development. We've also learned the importance of seeing through the vision that I want for the GMC. I'm not going to continue the rest of that paragraph, there's quite a lot of that. And he explains how hard a process it is. You also asked the question about the right of appeal and where we are around all of that. Norman Williams said earlier and in his report that the use of our right of appeal, which we only got at the end of 2015, has not been excessive. We've appealed about 1 in 8 of the cases which we could have appealed. Of the fitness to practice cases we have appealed, we've been successful in 16 out of 18 that have concluded. Indeed, Norman, in his report, said that the use of our right of appeal has been proportionate and appropriate, and that a case could be made for it improving patient safety. I believe that the evidence around the right of appeal is very strong. What Norman also said is we should review our processes informed by a review that the PSA is due to undertake, which we're very open to doing. It is probably for Mark, that's a reference to Mark Stobbs, the head of the PSA, to say exactly where the PSA has got in that process. Until the government legislate to take our right of appeal away, I still believe that we have a statutory responsibility to take action if we believe that a judgment by the medical practitioners tribunal leaves a continuing patient safety risk. To which Rosie Cooper then said, "So, the learning has not been really that great, has it?" So the current state of play is that that appeal will persist, as I understand it, until it's been removed by statute. But coming back to Bawagaba, in the paper, there are 3 points that I really just wanted to raise that perhaps arise out of that case that go slightly wider than perhaps just the question of appeals. The first is, I suppose, all to understand why the points raised are important, is in the Court of Appeal, the Court set aside the order of the first instance judgment, really explaining that a criminal trial is different from the disciplinary process, and the things that the disciplinary process looks at are wider than that which is looked at in a criminal trial. But that has gone on to inform a further debate about what precisely it is that is being looked at in the disciplinary context and indeed in the criminal context when you're looking at a case such as gross negligence manslaughter. And one of the key problems that's been identified with gross negligence manslaughter is it's a very difficult thing for a jury to be able to say what amounts to gross negligence. And that's not surprising, because there's no definition of it. And I'd probably go further and say it's a really difficult thing for a jury, or indeed a judge acting independently, to get a handle on what gross means in the medical professional context. Because what one's really looking at is a departure from professional standards. And you're supposed to approach the question not with the benefit of hindsight, where, for example, a patient has died, but rather what the foreseeable risks were at the time and the extent to which there was a departure. So gross is a really problematic problem. 2 further things arising from that case, from Bawagaba rather, slightly separate, the duty of candour. There's a real question mark about how these with hindsight reflections should be used and in what circumstances they should be used, either in particularly in the criminal context, because Dr. Bawagaba's own reflections of her wrongdoing were essentially used against her in the context of the criminal process. The third issue which arises is, and really does raise a difficult wider issue, is given that what one's concerned with in the disciplinary context is patient safety, is the extent of the duties to speak out about systems. Because in all of these cases, in fact, where medical practitioners are accused of wrongdoing, save for, let's say, the sexual motivated misconduct cases, but where what one's looking at is a professionally negligent act, it's very rare that it is the individual who's solely to blame. They form part of a system of care which was being operated, which may itself have been deficient, as it was in the Bowagaba case. And in those circumstances, there's a conflict or potential conflict between the duty to speak out about the unsafe system. And one saw that, for example, in mid-Staffordshire, where the doctors generally were afraid to speak out about the system and thought that, loyal to their employers and the other colleagues, they ought to just get on and work with the deficiencies that then existed. And that is, again, a real problem. And how, and there's a reference to it there in that reference from Charlie Massey, how those system factors are built in to an assessment of wrongdoing by an individual. I'll add to that a point that Robert Francis makes. When making that kind of assessment, how do those systemic factors fit in? The expert evidence is clearly important, but it's quite difficult to find an expert who has the precise experience of working in that either particular environment or that kind of environment. And so it raises a real question about how you can properly take into account the system in which the individual worked. Those are really the three points that I wanted to raise from that case.
So to conclude, just some observations about the Ray Chowdhury case. Anyone with a familiarity with that case will appreciate that we had a bit of an uphill struggle in resisting a finding of dishonesty against Dr. Ray Chowdhury. He was a locum paediatric registrar working in the accident and emergency department. He was informed of the arrival of a five-month-old child who'd been diagnosed with a chronic brain malformation. And in advance of seeing the young patient, he began to make entries in a pro forma A&E record. Now, in addition to filling out the history sections from other contemporaneous records, Dr. Ray Chowdhury also made a number of entries in the examination findings section in advance of seeing the child. It was his case that these were draft notes, an aide memoir, as he put it, and that he attended to amend the notes as necessary when he saw the child. He accepted that this fell below the standard expected of him, as set out in good medical practice, but denied any dishonesty. The GMC alleged not only had he been dishonest in respect of his note-keeping, but also, when questioned about it, that he'd given a misleading and dishonest account, not only to nurses, but to his supervising consultant over the telephone when asked about what he had done. The MPTS heard evidence from a number of witnesses, and eventually found that his conduct had been misleading but not dishonest, and issued him with a warning, having made a finding of no impairment. The GMC appealed that finding to the High Court. The central basis of its appeal was that the GMC had made a finding of fact that Dr. Ray Chowdhury had spoken a knowing falsehood to one of his consultants, and that was wholly inconsistent with the finding that he'd not been dishonest. The High Court substituted a finding of dishonesty and remitted the matter back to the MPTS for consideration of sanction. I represented Dr. Ray Chowdhury on his appeal to the Court of Appeal, together with Michael Deakin of these chambers, and the Court of Appeal quashed the finding of the High Court and restored the original finding of the MPTS. And there are two noteworthy aspects of this appeal. First, it's a very good example of deference and respect for the judgment of the MPTS in practice. Lord Justice Sales said this: in my view, the evaluative judgment made by the MPT in this regard should be given great weight. This is both because it had the advantage of seeing the appellant and the witnesses, so that it was well placed to make an evaluative judgment regarding the nuances of their interactions and the nature and seriousness of what the appellant did, and because the practical expertise of the MPT in being able to understand the precise context in which and pressures under which a doctor is acting in a case such as this. The second point is that it's an illustration of how the test for dishonesty, the new test as affirmed by Ivy and Genting, operates in practice. You'll all know that the old gauche test was the twin limbs of objective dishonesty, whether by the standards of the reasonable, honest people, what the doctor did was dishonest, and secondly, on the subjective limb, whether the doctor would himself have realised what he did was dishonest by those standards. And that's been changed to the Ivy and Genting test, where one simply looks at what the doctor knew and judges whether by objective standards, what the doctor believed, what his state of mind was, would be regarded as dishonest. And a close reading of that decision shows is that the Court of Appeal really adopted a nuanced and contextualised approach to dishonesty. It found that, taking into account his overall conduct, it was relatively venial and trivial attempt to deflect one consultant's ire in a specific moment, and was not dishonest, or was not, as it found, part of a dishonest and deliberate plan to cover up his conduct. It was also a very helpful rap on the knuckles for the GMC for overzealous use of their appellate powers, one that Jeremy and I at least hope the GMC will heed in the future.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.